Welcome back to Season 9 of Talking with Traders. We're into the fifth year of this podcast that began in 2020. Once again, IG have come on board as the sponsor of the podcast. We're truly grateful to have such a global leader in online trading as our sponsors. In the coming weeks, I'll be interviewing various guests from around the globe on the topic of trading. Some of these will be past guests that we invite back onto the show, and some will be new guests. The idea is to attract a broad spectrum of different perspectives from various players in different areas of the markets. None of what you hear here is financial advice, but it is intended to get you thinking about how you might be able to apply what you hear here to your own trading and investing. Remember to subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast app. That way, you'll be notified when new episodes are released. Or if you watch these interviews on YouTube, please subscribe to our YouTube channel and give us a thumbs up and leave a comment if you wish. We welcome the engagement. Once again, thank you to IG for sponsoring this podcast into its fifth year, and thank you listeners for your continued support. Now, let's get on to this week's interview. I'm actually going to switch sides, go to the other side of the microphone, and I'm going to be the guest for this week's podcast. And I've invited Giselle Willows from Nudging Financial Behavior to interview me regarding a blog article that I've recently written, which is all around investing and what I would say to my 21-year-old self if I could have the opportunity to go and talk to him and give him some advice. So with that as an intro, I'm going to hand over the mic to our host for this week's episode. Giselle, welcome to Talking with Traders. And the microphone is yours. I'm your guest for the week.
Thank you. It's so great to be here. And it's even better to have all the power in my hands. I'm going to ask you all your deepest, darkest secrets. No, thanks so much, Garth. And as you said, we're chatting here today because of this blog article you've written where you've given these investing lessons that you've learned at your lovely ripe age of 45 that you wish your younger 21-year-old self would have known. We'll be sharing the link to the article in the notes to the podcast. But maybe start by giving us some background as to why you decided to write this article.
Yeah, thanks. Well, why I started to write it was because I've recently befriended a young guy here in the UK. He's 21 years old. He's a filmmaker, does some really interesting and spectacular work, actually. He's just recently returned from a tour around Europe filming a motorbike series, which was part of Amazon. And he earns very well for the work that he does. He's basically managed to save up more or less two annual average British salaries, and it's sitting in a bank account. How did I meet this guy? Well, we both have a love of 1990s Mercs, and both of us drive a 1991 Mercedes SL500. So we kind of met like that, and we've become friends, and that's the connection. But being a petrol head, he now wants to spend his hard-earned money on an Aston Martin, and I've sort of said to him, no, that's not a very good idea. You've actually got the opportunity to really set yourself up financially for the rest of your life. You know, the kind of money he's earned as a 21-year-old is phenomenal. Very, very unusual for a 21-year-old to have that much money. But unfortunately, because he's young and naive and doesn't really have a whole lot of financial sense, he needs to be guided. And I'm trying to step into that role to guide him to be more financially responsible and actually to illustrate to him just how powerful it will be if he starts investing now at this young age of 21. And it got me thinking, as you said, I've just recently turned 45. And if I had the opportunity to go back and have a conversation with my 21-year-old self, what would I tell him? And that was really the background for why I wrote the blog article. And what also, I suppose, was the reason for wanting you to interview me on this podcast about it.
But now, Garth, you're better known as a trader. You run this trading podcast, you have a trading advisory service, and you've pretty much been involved with active trading your entire career. I mean, it's how I know you and probably how many of your listeners know you. And in this article, you refer mostly to buying and holding shares. And that's not usually the domain that you're known for.
Correct. It's not what I'm usually known for. But actually, you know, since 2008, I've largely been putting most of my own money into long-term shares and actually focusing more on the investing side of things rather than the active trading side. So yes, my business is in active trading, and I have been very involved in active trading, and I am an active trader, but I do it with a small percentage of my capital. Most of my capital is actually tied up in long-term share investments. And that came about after the financial crisis in 2008. You know, my early part of my career was very much in the derivative space. I was a futures broker. We were flying in the bull market up until 2008, made a lot of money out of derivatives. But the thing about derivatives is and the leverage that they come with is that when the crash happens, it crashes, you know, much faster. And I saw the nasty side of leverage and the nasty side of derivatives in 2008. And after that, I kind of decided it's, you know, the slow and steady approach actually does win the race in the end. So I became more responsible, started to invest more in shares. And whilst I am still very much involved in active trading and derivatives, I think there's a huge place for investing. And I do, as I say, I put most of my own capital into share investments, which I plan to hold for a long time.
You're basically saying that in the race between the tortoise and the hare, you're now backing the tortoise that usually wins.
Well, it is actually, it is usually the tortoise that wins, funnily enough. They say, you know, the fastest way to get poor quick is to try and get rich quick. So, and I've certainly seen that with futures and derivatives. You know, they have their place, there's no doubt about it, but they're very useful in the right hands. They're very dangerous in the wrong hands. And in all fairness, and as I say, because I'm now thinking back to talking to my 21-year-old self, I would say to my 21-year-old self, take the slow and steady approach, invest for the long term, with a long-term mindset and a long-term approach. If you're trying to, you know, force your way to rapid growth, often that doesn't end well. So be cautious, be careful, and just apply the right principles. And yes, ultimately, the tortoise does usually win the race in the race between the tortoise and the hare.
I think that links quite nicely to something you wrote in the blog about the whole instant gratification and how, you know, youngsters can obviously be quite blind to the power of time. And you talk about this concept of time quite a lot. So I'd really like you to just maybe go over that a bit for us.
Well, that's right. So time is an incredibly powerful asset to have on your side when it comes to investing. And Albert Einstein referred to compounding as the eighth wonder of the world. And the key about compounding and that eighth wonder of the world, though, is time. You need to allow time to do its work. And the more time you have, the more that compounding effect can become just so powerful. And so, yes, hence, you know, talking back to a 21-year-old has so much time on his or her side when it comes to investing. But as you point out, they are also a little bit blind to the power of that time when they're so young, and they often do want instant gratification. And I was there. I was 21 once, and I know, you know, you don't appreciate the value of time that you have on your side. But if you can harness that time and use that time to allow your investments to compound, the earlier you start, the better and the more powerful it is. And you will reap such greater rewards later in life if you start early and you allow time to do its work in terms of compounding your investment returns.
I mean, your new friend here is obviously quite fortunate that he has this lump sum that he can start and use. But what about people that don't have that lump sum? You know, how do they build up something that they can actually get on top of that compounding process?
Yeah, you're right. So it's unusual for somebody so young to have a lump sum like my friend does. Most people don't. And if you don't have that lump sum to start with, well, then the next best thing is just to start setting aside some of your monthly earnings every month and save it and invest it gradually, just bit by bit, continue to invest and be regular and be consistent about it, so that you ultimately build up that savings nest egg over time. And again, the point is just start as early as possible, save whatever you can afford to, delay the gratification of, you know, the fast car or the whatever it is that you want now, try and think about your future self and appreciate that the time and the effort that you put into your investing now and delaying that gratification will reap significantly greater rewards further down the line.
Yeah, I also often say that it's not so much about how much you save, but the actual principle and habit that you are saving that's actually going to set you up for success. But I want to come back to this instant gratification point because, you know, especially with millennials and Gen Zs and your friend that wants to buy his Aston Martin, you know, patience is also so important for investing.
Yeah, it is. It really is. And I think often we are impatient. We do live in a time of instant gratification, more so than ever before. So being patient is not something that comes easily, especially to the youngsters who have everything available to themselves quickly on a smartphone, on an app, whatever. You know, life is much faster for them. Patience is a little bit of a foreign concept to some of the youngsters, really. But it is so important when it comes to investing to be patient. And again, we keep coming back to this point about using time wisely and allowing time to do its work. But you know, you can't rush time. It is what it is. And you need to appreciate that and use it wisely. There's a saying which I really love. It's that the farmer that goes out at night to tug at his crops to make them grow faster goes hungry. And I think that's quite relevant when it comes to investing as well. You know, don't try and rush things. Don't try and get rich fast. As I said before, the quickest way to get poor quick is actually to try and get rich quick. So be patient. Just know that investing is a slow process. But it is also an immensely powerful process once you start getting that momentum of time and compounding behind you. It's incredible the power of time, the power of being patient. And I've shown some diagrams on the blog article, which as you mentioned, we'll link to in the show notes on this podcast. But it shows how the rapid growth, how your growth effectively becomes parabolic. Over time, if you allow compounding to do its work. And what we mean by compounding, if listeners are maybe not aware of what I'm actually talking about when I say that, it's talking about growth on growth. So whatever you earn in terms of growth on your investments this year sets you a higher base for the start of next year. And then you grow on that higher base. And then so in essence, the nominal returns that you're getting year in and year out become greater and greater because you're effectively adding layers of growth onto layers of growth onto layers of growth. In a way, I was thinking of, and I know I'm mixing my metaphors here, but think about it like rolling toilet paper onto a toilet roll. Okay. When you start, right, maybe you'll get one square around that roll, and you roll the second square, you get a little bit more. And another one and another one. As you roll it up, so each revolution gives makes that what's left there, what's on the roll, bigger. And that's kind of like this the concept of compounding, growth on growth. If you can think of that metaphorically and visualize that, that's what we're talking about here. Each layer of growth builds on itself and it becomes bigger and bigger and bigger over time.
Yeah, and I was looking, you referred to that graph that you show in your blog article, and I was kind of looking at it again, and I'm a real visual learner. So I just looked at it once again, and I just looked there and just saw, you know, over the long term, equity markets always go up. So just sit back and just wait for them to go up. If behaviorally we could do that quite easily.
Yeah, so it's always so easy in hindsight to look back at it, but you're quite right. Equity markets generally do go up over time, and there's two reasons for that. One is economic growth, and two is inflation. So first, the point around economic growth that also ties into companies growing their earnings. Businesses and management at businesses are obviously incentivized to grow earnings year after year after year. And as earnings grow, so typically share prices grow with earnings over time. And then the point around inflation is that, you know, we know about inflation, we know how it works, we know prices go up. Businesses therefore put prices up, grow their revenues just based on inflation. All of those things combined do tend to result in markets going up over time. And the further you zoom out on any equity index, you'll find that the longer the time frame that you're looking at, the more likely it is that you would have seen growth over that time period. Certainly, there are times where markets go down and there are bear markets and there are crashes and what have you. So it's not without its risks, and it's not always a smooth ride. But the further you zoom out on equity markets, the more you just see that the trend generally does go from the bottom left of the page to the top right of the page. And the reason for that, as I said, is because of economic growth and inflation, which are two tailwinds, if you like, that ultimately do tend to drive equity indices higher. So yes, more often than not, markets go up. They just don't go up in a straight line, but they go up more than they go down.
Yes, and if you zoom out and you've got time on your side and you know that these equity markets are going up, you can also then potentially take on more risk because we know the relationship between risk and reward. So high risk, high reward, low risk, low reward. So generally, the younger you are, the greater risk you can take. But it's also because you mentioned this in the article, there's also a fine line between taking that risk versus being reckless.
Yeah, that's right. So quite right. You do want to generally take more risk when you're younger because you've got more time on your side to repair any damage to your investment portfolio if there is any damage that happens from taking risk. Because obviously, as you said, taking more risk does introduce the possibility of well, higher reward, but the greater the risk and the potentially, you could have some negative outcomes. So what I allude to with that point is that yes, you should take more risk when you're younger, but you mustn't be reckless. And there is a fine line. The way I would sort of look at it is to say, well, let's define what it means to take higher risk. Taking higher risk in your equity investing means looking for businesses that are at the cutting edge of new technology, that have a long growth pathway ahead of them, and that can ultimately grow significantly over time. Of course, those businesses do come with higher risk. So therefore, don't put all your eggs in one basket. Diversify your portfolio, but diversify it across a basket of relatively higher risk stocks. They probably won't all work out, but most of them probably will. And that point around diversification is the element of not being reckless. So yes, take risk, but don't be reckless. Don't be reckless in the sense that you apply or you put too much of your money into one high risk situation. Spread it around a little bit. And that's really the point about that. And also this will tie in with some of the other things which we'll still talk about, in terms of cutting losses and making sure you don't sit on losing trades for too long, et cetera, which I know we're going to talk about a little bit more. But those are the points really. Think about, we know about the success stories of stocks like Google and Tesla and Meta or Facebook and Amazon, right? These are all businesses that at some stage were high risk businesses, but have grown to become phenomenally successful. Those are the success stories, but there are also some which at the time seemed like potentially high flying big growth businesses. Think of BlackBerry and think of Nokia. Those have effectively crashed and burned, So that's why I make the point you need to diversify because you don't know whether your what today looks like a high risk but potentially high reward play. You don't know whether that's going to become the next Apple or the next BlackBerry. Okay. But if you diversify, hopefully amongst the diversified exposure, you will find the next Apple or the next Amazon or the next Google, and you'll quickly be able to suss out which ones are working and which ones are not, and ultimately reallocate your capital towards the winners and trim back the losers.
Now that leads quite nicely onto another point you made in the article, a very important point, because when we think about the process of compounding, we generally talk about how when you earn dividends, you should reinvest them in your portfolio, and so compounding becomes even a greater power. But you talk in the article about how you actually favor growth shares over dividend shares. So maybe just explain to the listeners why you say that.
Yes, that's it. So remember, I'm talking to my 21-year-old self in the article or to my 21-year-old friend. So you're talking to somebody who's young and's got a lot of time on their side. And And for them, investing in growth shares makes more sense. There are times in your life where investing in high dividend yielding shares makes more sense. That's particularly when you're older and you're maybe more dependent on dividend income and stable income, and you don't have as much of a risk appetite. But if we're talking to a 21-year-old person in this in the article, and that's who we're thinking about here, you actually want to rather invest your money into growth shares as opposed to high dividend paying shares. The thing about high dividend paying stocks is that typically those are mature businesses that have no room for growth. They've often saturated their market, and because of that, they're very often large businesses. But they have no need to reinvest their profits back into the business to try and seek new growth avenues. So they end up paying out a large portion of their profits in the form of dividends. So if you think about the types of businesses that are typically high dividend paying stocks, it's often things like your utility companies, so electricity providers, water providers, telecommunications providers. These are businesses that are very mature. They've reached the growth plateau where there's no real growth avenue left for them. So they end up being hugely cash generative businesses. They make a lot of profit, but they typically pay those profits out in the form of dividends. So what you end up with is you get your nice juicy dividends, but you don't really get any share price growth of any substance. And if you go back and you look at companies like, for example, Vodafone or United Utilities, or National Grid, these are in the UK, these are sort of utility businesses. They've had no share price growth for like a decade. But yes, you've got your 6 or 7% dividend yield every year. However, if you had have rather gone and invested your money into some growth stocks, so if you'd gone and invested in the likes of an Amazon or an Apple or a Google or a Facebook, you've had enormous growth in the value of your shares over that time. You haven't had dividends because those types of businesses reinvest all their profits back into the business to grow the business and make it bigger. But ultimately, the growth in your investment has been so much bigger, so much greater if you've gone into growth stocks as opposed to these high dividend paying shares. And the other point on this point is that it's more tax efficient to invest in growth stocks that reinvest their profits back into their business. If you're receiving dividends as an individual, you get taxed. You have to pay dividend withholding tax, which is in South Africa, it's 20%. So you end up being taxed on your dividends, which is also not very tax efficient. So that's the point. And I mean, I made that mistake a little bit earlier on in my career, investing in high dividend paying stocks. And back in the day, we think about things like PPC cement and some of the banks in South Africa, and these were all high dividend yielding stocks, but they're mature businesses. So there's not much room for growth in those types of businesses. And I quickly realized that actually it was a mistake. As a young person, I should have rather been investing in growth companies and not being so fixated on high dividend paying stocks.
Yeah, and another thing you mentioned in the article, you say that nothing good happens below the 200-day moving average. Now you've got to unpack that for us.
Yeah, so the 200-day moving average is a technical term. Essentially, it's what it says. It's the average price over the last 200 days. So if you think about how many trading days is that, it's probably about 9 or 10 months in terms of number of days that you're combining. And your 200-day moving average is just an average of all of those prices. But what you particularly want to look at is the direction of that 200-day moving average. Is it pointing upwards or is it pointing downwards? And if the 200-day moving average is pointing upwards, it's telling you that that share price trend is rising. It's telling you that there are buyers coming in at every dip. They're coming in and buying the shares and pushing that price higher. If there's no appetite or there's limited appetite for the shares, they typically then will be underneath the 200-day moving average, and that 200-day moving average will be sloping downwards. And it's just a very simple filter to follow. Nothing good happens underneath the 200-day moving average. I think it was Paul Tudor Jones who was quoted as saying that. He's a very, very successful investor and trader. But it's just it's a good filter to have. Some will argue that the bargains can be found underneath the 200-day moving average. And to some extent, that is true, that there is definitely an element of truth to that. But I just think that in terms of creating a safety filter for yourself, if you stay on the right side of the 200-day moving average, then at least you know you've got a better than even chance that the trend is up, and and that's what you want as an investor. Any share price disaster that I've ever seen, think about stocks like EOH or Steinhoff, or African Bank. These are all disasters that they fell below their 200-day moving average a long time before any significant wealth destruction happened. And if one had just applied that as a filter, you would have avoided those kind of disaster situations. So I just think it's a good idea to stay on the right side of the 200-day moving average. If your shares are above the 200-day moving average and you've got the 200-day moving average pointing upwards, it generally means that the trend is in the right direction. And as they say, the trend is your friend until the bend at the end. So yeah, stick with it. Stick with the 200-day moving average that's pointing up. It's just a nice safety filter to have on your shares.
Yeah, and also because it happens quite slowly, you can sort of see it moving below the line, so you can kind of like take action without having to think too quickly. Because yeah, I mean getting the right share pick, I mean picking the right shares is difficult. It's not an easy thing to do. So you alluded to it earlier about this, which behaviorally is so difficult to do, but really is what we should be doing, which is cutting those losers quickly and adding them to our winners. So maybe talk us through that.
Yes, it's one of the cornerstones, the keystones of successful investing is run your winners and cut your losers. So there's no shame in being wrong. If you pick a stock and it doesn't work, there's no shame in that. We're all human. Nobody's perfect. There is shame in staying wrong, however. So if you make a share purchase and you realize it's not working, it starts to break underneath the 200-day moving average or whatever, starts to lose you money. There's no harm in cutting that position and reallocating that capital into something that's working better. Unfortunately, human nature is often that we don't want to take a loss, because it feels like a failure or it feels like a mistake. And all too often, I've seen people that firstly will refuse to take a loss, but then worse than that, they start averaging down and buying more when the share price gets lower, which is a really bad habit because that often means that you're onto something that's not working, but you're actually making your problem bigger by buying more and more of this share that's underperforming. You should rather cut your losers and hold on to your winners and even add to your winners. And if you can do that successfully, that's really the way to grow your capital, to see your investments flourish. Think about it like if you're gardening, you want to cut the weeds and water the flowers. And it's the same. You want to cut your losing trades or cut your losing share price position, you're losing stocks, but hold on to your winners and even add to them because that's the way you make a lot of money over time.
But you need to know the difference between a weed and a flower because I had something growing in my garden that I thought was a flower that someone last week told me was a weed. So you need to know the difference as well. Yeah, I mean, I found this point quite interesting that you wrote. You said active trading is not suitable for most people. And I sort of chuckled when I read it because, I mean, Garth, you've made your entire career out of trading.
Yeah, I have, but I also know that it's not for everybody. So I think it's an interesting space because actually the barriers to entry have become lower and lower over time. Now, to the point where there are apps available on your smartphone that you can literally open an account in 5 minutes and you can start trading. It's so simple. But the reality is that most people actually don't appreciate the amount of time and effort that goes into trading successfully. And most people lose. And that's not my opinion. That's a fact. If you go and look at the CFD providers and futures providers, they're required by law to post the percentage of their clients that lose money on the top of their website. So if you go and look at any of them, you'll typically find that the average number of clients that loses money is anywhere between 70 and 80%. And that's not to say that the other 20% are all killing it and driving Ferraris. Not at all. The other 20%, most of them are just scraping by and probably breaking even. And there's a very, very, very thin end of the wedge where there are successful traders who actually make a lot of money and can do it sustainably and successfully. But for the most part, most people are actually not cut out to be active traders. And those statistics bear that out. So I think it's important that people realize that it's not for everybody. Certain personality types are better suited to trading than others, but also don't underestimate the amount of time and effort that needs to go into being successful as a trader. It's not something you can do part-time as a hobby. If you're going to be a trader, you need to put your head down and really, really do it properly. And most people, A, don't have the time to do it properly, and B, actually don't have the right personality for it either. And for the most part, the majority of people would actually be better off investing their money in an index fund and leaving it rather than trying to trade their own capital. So it's just a health warning. As you say, I've done it successfully and I have made a career out of it, but it's not for everybody.
100%. Okay, the last question I've got for you, and then I have to give the power back to you. You say in your article that financial doomsayers are to be ignored. That's quite an important point, because in this day and age of social media, I mean, it's just rife with doom mongers or fear mongers to just, peddle their theories to the audience, and it's so easy to manipulate us into believing that. So do you have any advice you can share with us around that?
Yeah, it's very true. So the thing is, as human beings, we're kind of hardwired to be susceptible to threats. And that's going back to our primal instincts, really. So if someone comes along with information that is potentially threatening and warning of doom, market crash or collapse or whatever, those things do tend to pick our interest quite a lot more than good news does. Bad news always seems to sell. It's just a horrible part of human nature, I suppose. But when it comes to investing, we are susceptible to all of these doom mongers. And there are lots of them out there. And as you said, now in this day and age of social media and Twitter and what have you, we've got access to, these doom mongers have such a broader, bigger stage to peddle their theories. The thing is, they're mostly wrong. And I've been sort of a little bit of a victim of this in my career, where being human, I suppose, we pay attention to these threats. We listen to people like, Nouriel Roubini, who is, eternally bearish and gloomy about the world, among many others. And sometimes they're right, but most of the time they're not. And in my experience, actually, I would have been way better off just ignoring these guys. The end of the world is only going to happen once, if it ever happens at all. And if it happens, your investment portfolio is going to be the least of your concerns anyway. So until then, just accept that the sun is probably going to rise every day and markets will go up over time. Human ingenuity will continue to push boundaries. Investments will continue to grow on the whole, and just accept that that's been the norm for decades and centuries, probably going to continue being the norm. So don't listen to these doom mongers. They most of the time they're actually just unhealthy for your investment success over time.
Yes, rather look on the bright side of life and keep the negativity as far as possible.
Yeah.
Thank you, John. Yeah, I hope your 21-year-old filmmaker friend is going to read your article or listen to this podcast and make some sound financial decisions. Although I'm quietly sad that he's not going to buy the Aston Martin, but the financial decisions are definitely the better ones to be making.
Well, the thing is, right, is I was thinking about this because I know I was young like him once. I was 21. I also loved cars and I also bought some nice cars when I was younger. But when I look back on it, I think, gee, that was silly. I should have rather invested that money. If he avoids the Aston Martin now, he wants to spend about £30,000 on an Aston Martin. If he rather takes his money, invests it, and continues to invest it and allows it to grow over decades, I would estimate that by the time he's 40, he'll probably be able to buy an Aston Martin with 1 year's worth of growth in his investment by that stage, right? So let's say he's 40 and he's invested wisely. By then he's allowed a lot of time to for his investments to compound. I would hazard a guess that 1 year's worth of growth on his investment at 40 years old will buy him an Aston Martin then. And he'll still have a hell of a lot of money beside the Aston Martin as well. So, it's avoiding that instant gratification now at his young age, and rather being wise and smart with his money, allowing it to compound, and he'll be so grateful in time.
So maybe in 20 years you'll get a thank you letter and yeah.
Well, I hope so. I hope he takes the advice, and yeah, I hope he's wise and smart, because he really does have the opportunity to set himself up financially for life if he makes the right decisions now.
Yeah, and looking beyond him, I mean, yeah, just thank you for writing the article because it's really just 10 very practical lessons that you can just think about as a sort of a mantra, which can really just stop you from making poor decisions. And not only if you're young, I mean, even if you are in your 40s, these lessons can still be applied and you could still use compounding to your favor. It's not only for the 21-year-old. So they are
Totally.
very, yeah, practical.
Yeah, absolutely. But starting early is the key. But as you say, the best time to start was 20 years ago. Well, the next best time is now.
Yes.
So whatever age you are, it's never too late to start. Yeah.
Absolutely. Thank
Good.
you.
Well, thank you, Giselle. So I'll take back the mic again as the host of this podcast. It's been a pleasure being interviewed by you. Thank you for doing this. I really do appreciate it very much. And I hope the listeners have found this helpful and useful. And thank you again for agreeing to host this with me.
No problem. It's a pleasure.
Thanks for joining us for this week's episode of Talking with Traders, sponsored by IG, a world-leading CFD provider. We really are privileged to have such a strong global provider of online trading services as our backer for this podcast series. Remember to subscribe for more episodes by clicking on the subscribe button of your favorite podcast app. Or if you're watching on YouTube, please subscribe to our YouTube channel, give us a thumbs up, and leave a comment. We welcome the engagement. Till next time.